Oh, hello everyone and welcome to this webinar today. I'm Francis Seeley from GlobalNet 21 and a local group called EMPO Climate Action Forum. And today we're going to interview a local author because we like to interview local authors because they add a great deal to our locality, but they also add a lot to the literature that we read. And we're interviewing Stephen Cox today. Now we've interviewed him once before when he published his first book, and now he's done a sequel. So we're going to talk to him about that and his use of science fiction. So welcome, Stephen. You came on before, and when you did, you told us a bit about yourself. But because this is a new webinar, sure, maybe you could remind us and tell us just a little bit briefly about yourself.
Sure. Well, I've been living in Enfield since 2004 with my family. My most recent job was with the NHS, which I made throughout the pandemic, which was interesting. I left that early last year, late last year. And I'm, I suppose I've always been interested in writing, as in writing fiction, but I never actually got down to doing it. So in 2012, I started to write properly, and that's where the books came from. I've always been a reader, and that's always been one of my deepest interests.
And now you've sort of hit the publishing world, mm-hmm, pretty strongly. And we did an interview with you on your first novel, which was called, mm-hmm, Our Child of the Stars. Just to remind people, what was the theme of that novel?
Well, in the first book, Gene and Molly are a childless couple living in the United States in the time of Woodstock and the moon landings in a small town, not fairly conservative. And they adopt a wounded boy called Corey, who comes from the stars. And the theme of Our Child of the Stars is really, it's about parenthood. And it's about the fact that to keep him safe, they need to keep him secret. There are various sinister forces who would be very pleased to use Corey for their own ends. And Our Child of Two Worlds follows on quite straight after the end of the second book, of the first book. Sort of completes the story, as it were. They're two halves of the same story. And I think talking about the books, I mean, the first thing I'd say is they're fun. I mean, they do have ideas in them, and you know, they're supposed to make you think as well as make you gasp. But I think that they set out to be fun. They set out to talk about families and relationships and friendship and so forth in a very understandable way. But they, you know, as you say, they do have some science fiction ideas in them, and it's a sort of sweet spot, hopefully, between the emotional side and the intellectual side.
I mean, can you, without giving too much away, tell us a bit about what the theme is, what you're trying to say in the second novel?
Okay, well, I think that the second novel opens with Corey, the boy, is no longer a secret, which is a very complicated situation for the family. But they've had a few months of sort of dealing with worldwide fame. And the Earth is under a mysterious threat from space. And so the question is, where are Corey's people? If, you know, they should be here by now, they're not. Do they even know where he is? And this sets up quite a difficult tension, because the Earth probably needs Corey's people to come to tell them how to deal with the threat from space. But on the other hand, if Corey's people turn up, will they take Corey away? The analogy is used in the book, you know, if an American child is stranded on an island for 10 years, and the Americans find him, they'll probably take him back from the people who've been looking after him. So there's a real struggle between Molly, the mother's personal feelings about her son, her adopted son, and what might be best for the world. And that's one of the themes that's set up. The second one is always that one of the reasons I like science fiction is it allows you to use a magic mirror to cast light on reality, is that Corey's people are quite different from us. They don't have war. They don't eat animals. They don't have any form of discrimination. Violence in their society is very, very rare and seen as an illness rather than anything else. So obviously a naive 10-year-old, which is what Corey is, will see our world and see a lot wrong with it. He's very upset when he meets a pig and then realizes that's where bacon comes from. So he's the naive outsider who makes us look again at what we do and what we take for granted. And so that's certainly a theme in the book.
Well, we'll go through why you use science fiction, because that's really interesting in a minute. But the other thing that interested me, why did you set it in the period of Woodstock and Vietnam and so on? Why was it that time?
There's a glib answer to that, which is my first book was written when there were mobile phones. And mobile phones are really inconvenient for an author, and because you can Google stuff on them and you can nearly always get a message to somebody. And but I mean, that's a slightly flip answer. But I think it was deeper than that, which is that it's a very interesting time, the 60s. It's a time when people were challenging traditional views on race, on gender, on sex, on capitalism. People were starting to think about the environment seriously. And, you know, that great upswelling of thinking, some of which is very good and fresh and new, and some of which was a bit barking mad, was a tremendous ferment. And I think we've been like digesting the consequences of that upsurge for a long time. And there's absolutely no doubt, and this week we know there's no doubt that a great many things that I see advances since that time are now under threat and are being wound back. So I think there was also a sense in the air. I mean, I'm too old to remember the 60s in any detail, but there was a sense of optimism. You talk to people who are a little bit older than me, and there was a sense of optimism, there was a sense you could reach for the moon, literally. And I think that that's an interesting time to have aliens on Earth, and to think about what type of future we made and what a good job we've done of the idealism in the 60s or not. And I think the other thing is I found the more I wrote about the 60s, the more I thought I was writing about now. I mean, so it opens in a world where the president is keeping a war going that isn't necessary, where all sorts of injustices and difficulties, all sorts of people who call for, you know, peace and harmony and love are being attacked as drug addicts or whatever. And so there seemed to me to be a lot about writing about the 60s that throws light on now.
Yeah, I found it really interesting you did that. And of course, I'm old enough to remember the 60s and watch Paul McCartney at Glastonbury with great emotion. I mean, what's interesting as well about the book is you've got a stranger, Kari, who's adopted or taken over by Molly and her family, with compassion, without suspicion. But other people, when they find out about Kari, are deeply suspicious. They're worried about Kari. There's a lot of fear there. Is that a sort of parable to what is going on in the world today?
Yeah, you got me. I think that, I mean, I could, and one of the interesting things is I could have written this book about a couple in America or in the UK who adopt a child who's different purely within the world as it is now. And that didn't appeal to me for a number of reasons. I think I could do more with the alien in the type of book I wanted to write. But I think that even Molly, who loves Corey dearly, when she first sees him, is really quite disturbed. Firstly, because he's very sick, she thinks he's going to die. But secondly, Corey doesn't look human and doesn't speak English. And so he's a very extreme example of having to feel empathy for somebody who's different. And I think that, I mean, in fact, what happens is the first thing that kicks in is her professionalism. She's a nurse. Her feelings are irrelevant. She needs to get on with the job. And then she begins to see, you know, that this is somebody in pain. And so she gets away from that distancing and then ends up, you know, stealing him to keep him safe and loving him like a son, the son, that the child that they haven't been able to have so far. And I think that fear of other people and othering is just such a strong feature in our environment. And the way that discussions are had about complicated problems, which don't have straightforward situations, but deciding that the way to deal with the problem is to pick a group of people and make them the enemy, seems to be absolutely pervasive. And it's quite startling how when a government is on the ropes, it will decide to find somebody to blame who's nothing to do with the problem. And I think that Corey's people, who are absolutely lovely, though not perfect, start with being their ability to empathize and find solutions is higher than ours. And I didn't want to come along and say, all we have to do is, you know, I didn't want to write a utopia that humans should adopt, because that turns into a manifesto and that's a bit boring. But they do have some advantages that we don't have in trying to run their society. But I mean, hopefully they teach us something.
But it also shows us something else that I find very interesting, the conflict that Molly faces in her family. I mean, the conflicts between Jean, her husband, and Molly about how they should treat Cory, whether they should run away, hide, whether they should come out in the open and tell people about it. And you get a feeling that there is conflict going on because, you know, they're afraid of Cory being taken away. They also are afraid that Cory's people won't come and save them from the conflict that they've got. So in a way, there's a conflict there between, you know, saving your family and saving the planet. There's a selfish versus a cosmic principle, moral principle there. Were you trying to handle that as well?
Yes, I think that's another fair point. I think that, I mean, one of the things is that to keep Cory safe by keeping him a secret, they had to withdraw as much as possible from their friends and family. They had to keep a low profile. And one of the things that works itself out in the book is my own feeling that the last few years I have been tucked away in a hole, trying to hold on to my job and write the book. And that there's a certain call to action. There's never any doubt that Jean and Molly hold lovely, progressive, kind values. But in the second book, one of the things they have to discover is that you values what you do, not what you think. And you know, when you look at somebody, what they're actually doing about a problem is what their values say they should do about the problem. So I think that I mean, all these situations are very complicated, aren't they? And I think that the other thing about the book is it's very easy to write a book that's full of big ideas and flashes between lots of characters and ends up being rather shallow in terms of the people. And I very much wanted this book to be as accessible to an ordinary reader, somebody who doesn't necessarily pick up a book that's got a starship on the cover. And so I needed to make it as much about the family as possible and concentrate on their problems. And, you know, bringing up an ordinary child in ordinary times is complicated enough. But they form a lovely, because Jean and Molly don't see eye to eye through a lot of the second book about some of the things they're having to deal with. It's a lovely way of trying to discuss how you deal with such a complicated situation and, you know, show the humour of and fun of having a child, or being a child for that matter, but also the amount of time you spend late at night worrying about things where they're a chance under your control.
Right. I mean, the conflict that Molly and Jean faced between what they wanted to do as a family to protect Cory and, you know, existential threats, if you want to call it that, is a conflict that lots of people face, and particularly today in times of climate change. Now, in a way, science fiction helps you make that clear. It allows you, doesn't it, to dramatize the normal by the introduction of the abnormal. And so it's a really good vehicle for being able to tell that story.
Yes, I think that, so I'm all my life, I've known that there are people who aren't fans of it and they don't want anything made up in the book, The problem is every book is made up. Even if it's based on historical characters, it's still to some extent made up. But what it does allow you to do is make a twist or two in the world. And the world is immense. The world has these big, strange things going on, but it's a really straightforward copy of our world in many, many ways. You know, Simon and Garfunkel songs come on the radio and that sort of thing. And you can put a twist and you know, work through a different situation with a bit of distance. I think there've always been stories which bring a stranger to town to challenge people about what they think. There's always been the idea that sometimes a child sees more clearly than an adult. There's always been, if the world was run by 10-year-olds, we'd probably be doing more about climate change than we are. So it's a wonderful tool. And I think to criticize science fiction, some of it is too much about the machinery and not enough about the people for my liking. But it's a very big, robust, widespread genre. And there is now certainly far more stuff that's about the people than there was when I started reading it. And far more, and more of the very successful authors are writing about emotions than they used to.
But there's an element in your book as well, almost cowboy, between good and bad, God and Satan, in this case, the snakes or the enemy and the purple people or the good people. So there's a simplistic duality there.
Yes.
But you try to show, don't you, even though you've got that duality, that life is a lot more complex than that.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's war in heaven. Yes, we have the good aliens and the bad aliens, to put it quite bad and bluntly. And that's, but actually what the people broadly who are on the side of life want to do and can do about it is a very major theme of the last half of the book. I mean, I think stories of aliens tend to fall into the aliens are just as awful as we are, and they will treat us like we treated the Tasmanians and the Native Americans. The aliens will come in and tell us to tidy up our planet, or you won't get your nice technology from us. Or the aliens are weird or indifferent to us. And I think I wanted to work through something about what a real society that's not a human society, with its own conflicts. And I mean, the Khoury's people have their back to the wall in a way that they haven't for 1,000 years, dealing with this threat themselves. So you know, they can't just simply wander in and say, so saving the earth is our top priority, consider it done. So I think that you have to have dramatic tension. And it's one of the reasons why I'm a bit curious about utopias, because utopias get rid of, if you're living in a perfect society, the amount of things you can write about is drastically reduced.
Yeah, I think all was fine if we were living in a utopia. We'd get bored because there'd be nothing to fight for. But in a way, I mean, your Quaker background, does that come into it? Because in a way, you're also trying to get over the futility of conflict and the futility of war as well, aren't you?
Yes, I think one of the issues that you have to do about a conflict, like the conflict in Ukraine, for example, is whatever you think about it, you have to be really morally serious about it. So I have, I have friends who say the conflict in Ukraine is a silly way to solve a dispute, and I hope people would agree that Russia has moved into a large chunk of Ukraine against the wishes of its population and is deporting people and starving them and shooting them. And so, if you're a hardline pacifist, which I'm not, you have to own that if you're saying what they should do is resist passively or whatever. And if you support a war, you have to understand what the consequences of the war are. We're very gung-ho about the Second World War, many people would say it's one of the few just wars in our history, but it was enormously morally complex in what happened. We went to war to save Poland and we didn't, for example. So I think these things are need to be shown. I mean, first of all, it's not a lecture. I keep saying this. I really think books have to work as stories. Nobody's going to be cheering for the snakes to win. So that's fine, but what you do and what the cost is of what you do is a very difficult question. And of course, one of the things it does is that there's actually a protocol somewhere, apparently, where the Russians and the Americans agreed that if we were attacked by aliens from outer space, they'd cooperate to fight them. So, it's in that wonderful phase where Nixon, who was a horrible man, but had a couple of really visionary ideas, and one of which was he was going to bring China a little into the fold. So the president goes to China and he's got something really important to talk about, which is, will China and Russia and the US work together to defend the earth if they have to, which is messy, left messy and unresolved how far that would happen. But so I think that, and the other thing about Quakers is that actually they operate with a non-majoritarian decision-making process, which I'm not going to go into in any great detail, but works very well when we put our minds to it. And so obviously the Purples have got a non-majoritarian way of making decisions, which leads to the immortal quote from the president, how do they fight a war by committee? But there we go.
I mean, that's a topic for another webinar, non-majoritarian democracy.
Yeah.
And it, you know, it's something that is becoming, I think, talked about a lot more now.
Yeah.
But in your book, you deal with another theme. You don't forget politics. It's not there. You don't forget ambition. It's there very much. And it's there in the character of Dr. Pfeiffer, yeah, who, you know, is interested in Kari, not out of compassion, but because he wants to get his story out first into the public domain. He wants to be the person who is praised for doing it. So you also are trying to show that ambition and the desire for power is there as well, don't you? I mean, yeah, Dr. Pfeiffer comes to a pretty sad end, so that's your message about him. But you're trying to show that, aren't you?
Yes, and he is hubris, the great classical Greek idea. He is a very able scientist who chose to work very closely with the government because of his political views, which are very traditional. He's a traditional Cold War warrior. But he feels that he has the intellectual ability to be the person who can crack, you know, the complexities of Corey's biology. He can be the person who can negotiate from a position of intellectual power with Corey's people. He needs to be at the center of it all, and it doesn't end well for him. I don't think that's a spoiler, but I'm very careful to leave him he ends up sadder, but he does end up wiser. And I think I think Corey would probably be safe if he'd fallen into Dr. Pfeiffer's hands, because Dr. Pfeiffer is so desperately keen to keep him alive that Corey probably wouldn't, he'd be unhappy, but he wouldn't be dead. One of the great themes of the thing is if an alien turned up on Earth, it would be everybody would want a piece of them. The mob, the Russians, the American government, the peace movement, all sorts of stuff. I mean, I could have written a dozen books with this stuff, but I've written two.
I mean, all those themes you talked about could be written as a textual book. It could be written as a non-science fiction novel, but you chose science fiction, and we've talked about that. But is the sort of positive thing about the value of science fiction that it allows you to suspend normal conventions and anything goes?
Yes, and fantastic literature in general. The difference between science fiction and fantasy is not quite as rigid as people think. I think that the you're able to make a change that allows you to cast a better light on what's going on, and it allows you sometimes to code that quite a little, and sometimes it allows you to code it quite a lot. I think that first and foremost, a book has to entertain, and in my view, has to have people who are interested in, even if those people are computers or aliens or whatever. I think it's, science fiction could be prophetic, and I don't mean prophetic in the way that it tells you exactly what's going to happen, but I think it's prophetic in the sense of a warning, because the prophets in history tended to be, if you carry on doing this, it will be bad, rather than this is the exact future you're going to get to. So I think we need to think about the future. And it's really interesting that most of the issues that we're dealing with society now, I can say, oh yes, I read a story about that written in 1950, which wasn't a very good story, but it had that idea in it. Meat grown in laboratories, artificial intelligence, people have been writing about climate change for a while. And the other thing we have to think about, and I'm going to talk about optimism, because actually there's a widespread view among people with power that we don't want to deal with climate change because we'll be fine. we've bought a farm in Scotland or a farm in New Zealand, and we're going to be fine. And they are propagating the view that, you know, it isn't a problem, it's not fixed. And then they propagated the view that it was unfixable, and now they propagate the view that we should have acted earlier. So there's a real case for climate pessimism being put after 20, 30 years of telling outright lies about what the data showed. And I think that there is a need to create not just stories of warning, but stories of optimism, stories that people can work their way through things, that even now, maybe we can't act as decisively and well as we could have done 20 years ago when the case was very clear. We can act, we can make a difference. We may not save, we may not be able to save the gorillas, but we may be able to save something else. You know, we may be able, every fraction we can get off the climate rise, every adaption we can make is important. And so I want to keep alive the idea of hope and optimism. I didn't feel very optimistic writing the book, but I hope that the optimism sneaked its way in, because that was my intention. Not that we will be okay, which is complacency, but that we could be okay. We could take a decision to act and to be better.
And using science fiction, I mean, does science fiction enable you to tell a moral tale that would seem a little self-indulgent if it wasn't for the science fiction genre? Yeah.
I think so. I mean, I think that I think it's creeping more and more into the mainstream, because, you know, our life is quite science fictional now. I think that my godfather used to send me these books, which were very clearly trying to induct me into one particular wing of the Christian faith. And, you know, even as a child, you can spot when you're being lectured to. But it just gives you such an enormous freedom. And I think I want to see is sometimes a literary author will pick up a science fiction idea and use it. I want us to worry a little bit less about the label on the book and more what the ideas in it are being used to do. I mean, I've come to see that Corey is actually, Corey's story, Our Child of the Stars, Our Child of Two Worlds, fits quite nicely into mainstream science fiction. It's just in sort of one corner of it, which is more about families and emotions, than the other bit, which is more about machines going bang.
Were you influenced by other science fiction writers like Ursula Le Guin, for example, who has a very clear message to give out?
Yes, I mean, she's an extraordinary writer, taken from us now, unfortunately, but she's extraordinary actually because she's self-critical, and her work consists, some of her work is her working out what was wrong with her earlier books, and she grew as a person and as a writer. And she was the first, I mean, when I picked up The Wizard of Earthsea, which is a fantasy, when I was about 9 or 10, it was a book where the hero doesn't win by destroying what's attacking him, which is an extraordinary idea in the context of most of the other books I'd read. Yes, I think I was very influenced by a particular ethical strain of American science fiction, actually. Stories like Ray Bradbury and Ursula Le Guin, there are some very good people writing now who are very interesting, who take a much wider view of who's important and who can be centered in a story. I think that it's a field that evolves. I think that a lot of the stuff that was lauded in the 80s, a lot of stuff that was lauded in the 60s, life has moved on. Some of it's still relevant, a lot of it isn't. Partly because stuff which says that only stories about white men are interesting is, not the way the world is, not the way the world should be. And it's always very funny to read science fiction that's written even 20 years ago and think that its attitudes are so behind where we are now, or behind where the progressive half of the country is now.
Okay, so you've written these two books, and they follow sequentially from one to the other. Mm-hmm. Is this where you stop, or have you got another book in mind?
Okay, so I've written the first draft of another book, which is quite different, and I'm working on that now. What I'll tell you about the story of Corey and his family is two books, Our Child of the Stars, Our Child of Two Worlds. One follows from the other. And I think I land the story somewhere where we can leave them for now. We can land them where they are not the center of the universe anymore. That I've said I'm not against returning to that world, because it's a lovely world and I've spent 10 years writing it. I might write a book in which those characters exist, but they're not the center of the universe. What I'm writing now is something that actually is partly to address our own national delusions. It's set in Victorian England and has a different premise. And I'm telling the story through a couple of characters who aren't as admirable in many ways as Jean and Molly are. But it's a story that we are partly a creation of the Victorian era. We are greatly deluded about much of it. And that's sort of tucked into it, but it's mostly a romp. It's people running around faking seances and getting all. I've got a list of Victorian cliches, all of which I've ticked off so far. So yeah, it's going to be great.
Well, that sounds like another webinar when it comes out, another interview, because that sounds a really interesting theme. And I think exposing delusions is really important. So, I mean, we come to the end of the 30 minutes now. Now, if anybody wanted to get in touch with you or find out more about your book,
sure,
where would they go?
So I have the usual things. I have a website, stephencox.co.uk. which I hope is recent easy, Stephen with a PH, Cox, COX. I'm all over the place. I've got a website, I'm on Twitter, I'm on, I have a Facebook page, which is Stephen Cox Author. And I think, you know, if all else, if you can't find me any other way, you can email my publisher, Joe Fletcher Books, and I'll pass it on. But I think I'm fairly easy to find. The only thing slightly odd about me is my Twitter handle is at Stephen WHQ for long and boring reasons I need not go into. Stephen WHQ is my Twitter. So really, I'm as one needs to be in these days, I'm trying to be as findable as possible.
Okay, well, thank you, Stephen, for doing that, because that was interesting. And you've demonstrated quite clearly how two books have been based upon deep thought about the world and how it is and how it should be, which clearly your next book's going to be, but in a different way as well.
Yeah.
And those books are always interesting, and they're books we need to read now. We need to talk about the world we're in and the mess we're in and how we get out of it, if we can get out of it. And I think your book adds to that. And in a time of climate change and international conflict, those books add a lot to our thinking. And, you know, we can't shut ourselves away and not think about them. So your book helps. So, thank you very much for doing the interview. Thank you for writing the two books and enabling us to interview you on it. So it's been great.
Absolute delight, Francis. Absolute delight. I'm very, very pleased. And as you say, if any of your listeners want to get in touch, they're more than welcome.
Okay, well, thanks a lot, Stephen. That's great. And we'll end this interview now.